This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, our annual Conundrums show.
If you were president, would you rather be remembered for having really great domestic policy and really lousy foreign policy, or the opposite?
So you are now president or in charge of your alma mater. And in line with all the recent economic and budgetary concerns, you have to cut a department. What department do you cut?
Okay, so the conundrum is, if you're running for Congress in a tough district and you've got a scandal on your hands, would you rather it come out that you're gay or that you're an atheist?
Is it better to be funny or smart? And other confounding questions about life and politics. I'm David Plotz. Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz, live at the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco, California. It is time for our annual Conundrum Show, in which we tackle the confounding life questions, both profound and silly, that our listeners have posed to us. Should you bother to vote? Who would you travel back in time to kill? And many more. Joining me on the Rickshaw Stop stage is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
That's more like it. And Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
Okay, so the first question. Would you prefer, Emily, to be funnier or smarter than you are?
I feel like I'm supposed to answer smarter, because you could always use being smarter, and I certainly could be a lot better at math and at remembering things, but I think I would pick funnier, just because I get so much pleasure out of the small moments in which I accidentally succeed at being funny. It would be really great to do it on purpose sometimes.
Right, you mean intentionally, intentionally funny. What's the purpose of this? Is this to...
enjoy life.
Yeah. Oh, if it's just to enjoy life and be fun at parties, then it would be that you want to be funnier.
Well, maybe you would get more out of being smarter. Maybe being smarter would make you better at many more things.
But I thought we were just trying to have fun at parties.
Well, you get to pick.
Oh.
But the thing is, when you are funnier, you appear to be smarter. People equate you being funny. Like John, you're a pretty funny person, and people think you're smarter.
Little do they know.
Which is part of the big ruse of the whole damn thing.
You would pick being funnier.
Oh, definitely, I would pick being funnier. Although there is
funny at all.
This is how the show is going to go. I'm going to enjoy it a lot.
Wait, well, you started it.
Okay. All right, so I would say I would mostly pick being funnier, but there's a kind of... I remember once Slate used to be owned by Microsoft, and we once had a small meeting with Bill Gates back when he ran Microsoft.
A notorious cut-up.
Yeah. But I remember being in the room with Bill Gates and thinking, you know, Bill Gates is obviously really smart, but he's not smart in a different way than, you know, we're smart. It's just like he's on at 100%. Most of us are on at 90%, 60%, 30%. He's on at 100%.
So you could run with Bill Gates.
I was thinking like, no, it wasn't. I was thinking that me at my absolute best was sort of what Bill Gates was at all times. So I wouldn't want to be like Bill Gates. I would want to have an intelligence. If you could have an intelligence like an Einstein intelligence that makes connections that you just can't make, that would be fun to have. So I would pick that kind of smartness.
Genius.
I would pick genius rather than just smarter. Yeah.
The kind of intelligence that would find a whole new category when given just two.
Yes.
So genius is a
just
big
like,
burden. Oops. Yeah.
The show is now
going to
fall apart.
However, in order to become a genius, you lose your ability to function with your motor skills.
I think it's hard to be someone with that level of genius, that in fact it often comes with a great deal of trouble and whirl and chaos. I'm not sure I would actually want that.
So you just want to be funnier.
I think so, yeah.
All right. We'll do a quick audience poll. So you're going to have to express with applause and whooping, smarter or funnier. So first we'll do smarter, then we'll do funnier. Would you choose to be smarter? Okay. Those are what we call the techies. Would you choose to be funnier? Those are the people who are standing in front of the Google buses.
John, you never picked, did you?
What?
Did you ever pick?
And I try to go through these things and throw up enough gorilla dust that I don't actually have to make a selection.
I know, but yeah. That seems like a bad way to begin.
Okay.
No, it worked out fine.
Let's do a second. We'll do a second conundrum. This one comes from Jody Avergan and actually his great podcast, Ask Roulette. Jody passed this on to me. So you have a child. You have a wonderful one-year-old child. You love that one-year-old child. And you discover when your child is 1 year old that because of a mix-up at the hospital, it is not actually your child. Do you seek to return the baby and get your biological child? Do you live with?
Yeah.
I think the warranty in Washington is only 24 days.
Well, you have to fill out that damn little card, and then you have to remember to mail it.
Yeah, you have to mail it in. It's all that number is really long.
Right.
John.
Yes, you return the child.
You return the child.
Oh, I don't think so at all. I would totally keep the child. I mean, I would worry
and live
about
with the crushing guilt your whole life of not having returned the child and gotten back your child.
But I think your child is the child you raise more than the child who's biologically related to you.
Well, that's true in a an adoptive context or in a.
But this is like an accidental adoptive context, right?
Right, but I think consent has got to be a part of adoption. I haven't done it. My wife's adopted, so I have some familiarity with it, but I'm pretty sure consent was involved.
Right, no, absolutely. And you're thinking about it maybe from the point of view of the other family as well as from your own point of view.
I
see that.
So
but.
I'm with you, Emily. But okay, John, what if the child is, you discover this at 18, the child's 18, you return the child then?
By the time the child's 18,
wait, no, I just we're having a little Socratic dialogue.
Yeah. So and so, presumably you pick the age of 18 because the child has consent.
18 at 18, yeah. Do you?
But is if my estate were 18?
17.
Okay. So your point of choosing 18 wasn't about whether the child
17.
Has consent over there.
Answer the question.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I'd let the parents know of the
letting.
But at that point, that's what it
returning
is.
I mean, at that point, 17, returning is not a.
So how about this? With the one-year-old, do you have a responsibility to tell the other parents? Maybe you don't actually go through with the exchange of children. Maybe you keep the child that you've raised.
Well, sure, but then you've consented. I mean, then you've come to a mutual understanding with the parents, and that's.
And then it could be.
So, Emily, you're saying you wouldn't tell.
I think I imagine that I would be deeply attached to the child I was taking care of, and I wouldn't want to risk anything.
But you wouldn't tell.
I don't think I would, because I don't think I believe in the biological connection being important enough to make it worth risking the actual real attachment.
Interesting.
Would you tell?
I think I would tell. I agree with your sentiment. I totally agree with the sentiment.
See,
I don't care. I mean, you could hand me any child.
Tell.
I would happily raise it if you told me it was my child. But... Yeah, I guess I would tell, but I don't think I would necessarily reach the conclusion. Certainly, if the child was, 10, there's no way I would automatically conclude this child should go with the other, its biological parents. Or if the child was, if it was one day, definitely it goes with the biological
parents. Right, so when do you
hit the... it's just a question of where you draw
where
that.
There it is.
Right.
Right. Right, one day is just like a funny ha-ha mix-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, one day it's like a reality show. You know, it's like
Freaky Friday.
Get those developers in here.
There was a great This American Life about this, where these kids.
Yes, by my friend Jake Halpern.
Yeah,
I was thinking about that because what made that a great story was one of the families knew all along that the child wasn't their child and never revealed it.
And so you would want it. That was clearly the wrong.
You're just
choice
trying to get on This
to
American
show.
Life.
Yes.
And you.
It's true.
Wait, but yet you side with that now. Now you're like, we don't tell anything. We're
I think as a parent, the idea that you are going to give back this child who you believe is yours, to me, the subjective reality of believing that a child is mine and taking care of the child matters more than the biology of it.
We'll do another audience poll, and then we'll go to one of your conundrums. So would you return that one-year-old, or would you keep it? First, would you return the one-year-old? Would you keep the one-year-old? Wow, that is closer than I would have expected. All right, let's take an audience conundrum when you say your name, too, unless this is a very sensitive conundrum, in which case don't.
Not at all. My name is Matt Cook. Hi. So you are now president or in charge of your alma mater, and in line with all the recent economic and budgetary concerns, you have to cut a department. What department do you cut?
Oh, that's a great one.
That's a great question.
Oh,
hold on.
Slate recently,
and this can be academic as well as extracurricular or like sports as well, right?
Okay. Do we have a football team?
I'm cutting curling.
Yeah. All right. I think Stop that.
Minnesota's in the house.
I think we should. I think not. I think it has to be academic.
Sports.
Yeah. Otherwise, we'll all have to pick sports dutifully.
Wow.
I don't think this is that hard. I can think of like 10.
Okay, go ahead. Start.
Well, this is Madame Lafarge over here.
I would start with all the languages nobody is studying anymore, really. Like Italian
French.
Is really small. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, everyone.
Nice.
This is true.
The whole
Russian
audience is adjuncts, by the way. Although they couldn't afford the ticket, so they're just dates.
I would start with the languages that have really teeny followings, of which, I'm sorry, but there are several. Sanskrit. Almost nobody takes it. Italian, French would probably be okay. Russian. Yeah, people are not in this country are not really studying Russian in college that much anymore.
John,
how about semiotics? Can't you find something?
I know. I'm reeling from you went right after Italian at the beginning.
I'm sorry.
The most. Gosh. Oh my God. I'm sorry. I'm reeling, David. You're gonna have to bail me out.
I am struggling here. Both my mother and my brother or English professor.
How about like comp lit?
Are you struggling because you would cut out English?
No, because I come from an academic family.
Right. What about all the sort of fishy interdisciplinary programs like global affairs? And no, I'm serious. They're not
tied. I would cut out all the ones in our profession. All the community.
Yes, and rhetoric. Yes. The entire journalism department.
Yeah.
Gone. Yes. Phew, thank God you saved me.
I think you have to say why to make it more.
Because you'd rather know something, and so learn about history, learn about biology, learn Italian, and then if you learn the thing and you know about the thing, you'll find a way
to
say
it. So we essentially think that media training communications is all sort of a patina of on top of everything else. And we're
well,
tired
it's
of
no our Italian, but
yeah. I think Italian wins, though. I think Italian wins. Definitely wins. I would get rid of it before communications.
Have you been to Italy?
Si. Okay.
Ciao.
Okay. All right. We're gonna do a very quick. Again, this can't be by vote, but I'll take the first three hands I see, and you're gonna tell me the department you're gonna get rid of. Biz.
No.
Come. How are they gonna fund it? All right. That's number one.
No one gives any money.
All right. Business.
Again.
We're getting rid of business. Anyone else? No one else wants to get rid of anything. In the back. Dance. Is that a department?
Is that not at Carnegie Mellon?
Yes, sir. Philosophy.
Oh, no. Wait, why are you on a conundrum
really?
Show? You're going
like
to get rid of philosophy?
I was afraid to say it. I was terrible in philosophy.
Well, why? It's all
I
logic.
Know, but you got to.
By far, my worst grades in philosophy.
That's very surprising to me. It's a logic game, and you're super good at logic.
I don't know.
What did you not understand?
I didn't get it.
Did you take it your first year?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we all did.
Yeah, it was terrible.
It was fun, though.
I liked it.
Food science.
Although, actually,
that
is daring to say in San Francisco.
Oh, that's true.
I see.
Coming up, one vote never makes a difference, so should you bother to vote? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next conundrum, which comes from Phil Goldstein, I think, GabFest listener. So who would you travel back in time to kill, but it cannot be Hitler, Mao, or Stalin?
John, you have to go first.
Can I kill two people?
You can kill two birds with one stone.
What if it's a silver bullet? So I think Bin Laden for not only 9/11, but then everything that 9/11 unleashed. But then I think also, and I was just looking up to see who was the inventor of botulinum toxin, which is the most, when it's weaponized,
I thought you were
going to
say who's the inventor of Facebook.
Yeah, no. I think Arnold Bergen appears to be the person that, because it's just the most, like,
toxic.
Gruesomely deadly
That's
weaponized poison gas.
I was going to choose Pharaoh.
Pharaoh?
I went all the way back in time.
Oh,
Pharaoh. Did some serious damage.
But he let your people go.
Well, I know that's our the people problem, go. Is that in the end it all works out. And then I was trying to undo, like, what if the Jews, the Hebrews hadn't been enslaved? It seems like a big piece of history to let go of. So then I was thinking
FYI, it never happened.
Then I was thinking about, like, wiping out humans from the earth, and actually that would be God right before Noah and saving Noah's Ark. That was like a really confusing choice to pick, but I was sort of drawn to it. What about you?
If I could move away from you any more than I already am, because I'm pretty sure the thunderbolt has a bit of a blast radius.
No, God has a sense of humor.
Yeah, that's true. The Old Testament God is a next to Bill Gates. He is really.
Would he rather be funnier or smarter? Or,
yeah. when you're omniscient, I think you can be both. Both.
All right, the one I thought of actually was it's a weird choice. Thomas Jefferson for the pernicious pushing of states' rights at the formation of the United States. The idea that the individual little states have kind of a tyranny over the nation turned out to be a really bad precedent.
Huh. Wow. But he did some good stuff. Really pro-education,
so
freedom
did God.
Of religion. Okay. That's a good point.
There would be no University of Virginia, hence no John Dickerson on the stage also.
You don't think any other school would have taken John?
Actually, really a point of fact, I think that was about... Never mind.
All right, we'll say again... let's take a couple from the audience. Anyone have a good nominee for who they would kill? Right there on the floor. Otto von Bismarck.
Is
why?
That the person who started World War I, essentially? Yeah, well. No.
He formed Germany, for forming Germany. All right. Any other vivid nominations? Right here. Christopher Columbus, that was my other choice. That's a good one. Because without Christopher Columbus, right, it would have been a gentler, probably it would have been a gentler conquest without him.
Yeah, because he was the, I mean, don't you figure somebody else would have come a couple of years later?
Definitely someone else would have come and it would have been bad, but don't you think like that he was a particularly bad guy to do it? He was like a slaver. He was really avaricious and horrible in a way that maybe some of the others, the people who came after him were.
The wrong emissary, the wrong guy for the job.
No?
Yeah, that seems pretty good to me. How about who started?
Also, then we wouldn't need an Italian
Is there
department?
Someone we could blame the Crusades on? The Crusades, the Inquisition, the Khmer Rouge, Rwanda.
Pol Pot would be a good...
Pol Pot, that's an excellent choice.
Pol Pot.
Jim Jones.
Mm. Wow. Jim Jones, responsible for killing the only congressman ever killed while in office.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the question from... We'll go do a political question from Julius Shoresman. Since an individual vote basically never makes a difference, why should any individual bother to vote? Wouldn't your time be better spent on election day doing anything else, like doing your internet startup?
No. So my answer to this one is that if you don't vote, you send the message that other people don't have to vote, that voting is not worth anyone's time, and that even if that is true individually, it is so crucial to the democracy and the polity that we all vote collectively that you absolutely take the time to vote. You're setting an example, and you're also taking part in the only kind of direct political power that we have.
What?
Someone going to make the case against voting?
Well, David will, but here's the thing, though. If you, let's say you participate in all kinds of different ways, like you organize for your causes, and even at the federal election level, you have a blog that educates people on issues and do all that stuff, and then you don't vote because you feel this way. In other words, you've contributed to the process, but you don't just do the act.
I mean, I think that's better than doing nothing at all. I don't really think very many of those people exist, because I think when you're involved and you're organizing, you're also very likely to want to go exercise the franchise, right?
What about not voting as a political act? If you say that there's a system that is so profoundly broken that participating in it validates the system. Voting in a presidential election in California or in Washington, D.C., where I live, it's like, what's the point? My vote truly doesn't make a difference. It's going to be...
Because you're running up the tally for your candidate.
If I happen to believe that the electoral college is itself just a bogus, flawed instrument and we shouldn't have it, and that my participating in it just gives it weight, whereas if I deprive a vote and cause lots of other people to deprive it and vote counts are suppressed, people may think, oh, we need to reform
the system. If you organized a boycott or started a third party and then publicly announced, I am not voting, and we're making that a political act, yes, that could be valid. But just sitting at home on your hands doesn't have any kind of political meaning. So, no.
What she said.
All right. All right, let's check with the audience. So, should you bother to vote? We'll do first, you should bother to vote, then you shouldn't bother to vote. So, you should bother to vote.
Wait, no.
Preaching to the choir. Who's going to be? Well.
You shouldn't bother to vote.
Yes.
That was awesome that people didn't vote in the vote or not vote.
Let's go to a next audience conundrum. We're going to do it in the back.
My name's Alex. If you were president, would you rather be remembered for having really great domestic policy and really lousy foreign policy, or the opposite?
Well, I guess it depends, right? So Kennedy used to say, you know, with foreign policy, I mean, with domestic policy, you can just lose an election, but with foreign policy, if you screw it up, you can die, because, of course, he was living under the threat of nuclear annihilation. So how bad would your foreign policy have to be?
I guess I sort of feel the opposite about it, which is that the foreign policy is the one in which you have less control over what it will mean in the long run, whereas the domestic policy, you have more of a chance of actually affecting change. Obviously, there's a lot you don't control, but more of the levers are in your control.
Except presidents end up leaving office thinking, I had no control over domestic policy, but I could do stuff in foreign policy. Because the stuff they can do we don't even know about.
Right.
Well, but President Obama, he has the stimulus, he has Obamacare, he will have Supreme Court justices he nominated. Those are some significant domestic policy accomplishments. Won't he leave office thinking, I'm really glad I got health care for all Americans? Right. That's better than the fact that I botched, you know, Iran, that we invaded Iran.
We did not invade Iran.
I'm just saying, we also didn't get health care for all Americans. You know? they're both fantastical notions.
Right. Well, it depends on the outcome, right? So let's say healthcare is a total catastrophe and the whole thing comes unwound, and then you have peace with Iran.
Maybe domestic policy, you can feel like there's a significant legacy and achievement, whereas with foreign policy, it's simply that you don't blow it, right? Blame versus credit.
Probably. There's a good deal of foreign policy stuff that we wouldn't even know about.
I think just because I'm an egotist, or an egomaniac, I would take domestic policy, because I think that's where you get credit from your own people. Like, your own people remember you fondly if you have domestic policy achievements, and they don't particularly care if you have foreign policy achievements.
Right.
And they last. They feel like they last a little bit more than the foreign policy ones, which can come unwound.
Certainly your American press would be better. You would get more accolades for domestic achievements.
All right. This is a question that we've all been – we had this in advance, and we've been pondering it, so – there's no excuse for blowing it, which is, which fictional character would you like to be? A character from a book, from a movie, from a play, from dance? Which would you want to inhabit their life for some limited period, more than a minute, less than 18 years?
Because if it was more than 18, you'd have to give it back?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Emily.
Well, I want to have some magic, right? I mean, if you get to pick any kind of fictional character, you could go to a magic world. So, and I love the character in Philip Pullman's trilogy, His Dark Materials, the character of Lyra, who gets to, right? She's like this unruly, kind of unwashed hair little girl who gets to go all over the place and fly with witches and hang out with the armored bear. So that was my first choice. Yeah. And kill God.
Just like you.
It's a theme here.
That's a great – Emily was – when we were talking about this before the show, Emily was just really not doing well. She had – what's her name from Portrait of a Lady?
I was thinking of all these feminine heroes, Lily, Bart, David broke up, but they all have really sad endings. It was just a parade of horribles. Lyra's a great choice.
That's a great choice. John, what about you?
Sometimes I want to be Samwise Gamgee. He seems like a really – very happy, contented guy. Yeah. He's got a garden. He eats well. He builds strong friendships with those near him. The character that really first drew me in another part of my life was was Marlowe in The Heart of Darkness, because it's narrated through him, right? And so the observations that he makes in that novella, you know, I mean, they're obviously Conrad's, but he had a good eye. And so, you know,
I forget what happens to him.
Marlowe's fine. He goes down, okay. He finds Kurtz. Kurtz is insane. He comes back, okay. And he's disillusioned and bitter.
Doesn't sound super fun. I don't think you've picked.
Well, this
super
isn't
fun
the fun person. Or smart contest question.
Okay. I'm just pointing
this
that
just,
out to you.
He just has a very sharp. He has a good sharp.
All right, so
eye.
You're coveting his intellectual skills. Yeah. All right.
So I picked three. So, because they each reflect different things. So one would be, I think, Sherlock Holmes, for the same reason as that Albert Einstein, like to inhabit somebody who has a different way of thinking about the world, and it's just so...
He's kind of irritating.
Incredibly irritating.
And hence the attraction for David.
The worst.
The
second one is, I don't know any of the names of the characters, and I read this book when I was 13, so it's probably terrible, but... is in, I think it's Arthur Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama. There's these characters who encounter an alien spacecraft and get to explore an alien spacecraft. They're the only humans who ever get to do it. And to be the person who gets to experience an alien civilization directly, I think would be amazing. And then the third one would be Jesse from...
Breaking
from Jesse's Girl.
No, from Before Sunrise.
Oh, right,
because
you love
get
those
to sleep
movies.
With Julie Delpy. Oh, so God. It would be awesome. That would be the best.
He's kind of turns into a sort of doddering old fool at the end of those movies.
Just
that's
the
okay.
first one. Just the
all
first
right,
one.
All right, all right.
Okay, let's do the trolley problem. So this has been much brooded about. So I will briefly describe it. If I botch it, the philosophy majors in the audience can correct it. So the trolley problem is this. So one version of it says... you are standing next to a train switch. There's a train barreling down the track. The train, if it continues on the track it is on, is going to run over five people who are tied to the track up ahead of you. To the left, if you turn the switch, there is another track that you can shunt the train onto where it will only kill one person who's tied to the track. Do you flip the switch to move the train to the track with one person? That's the first part of it.
Got it. I was promised there would be a trolley in this question.
So it's two parts. It's the 5-1, simple 5-1. Do you intervene from the 5-1?
Uh-huh.
So if you intervene, you are, you know that you are killing one person. And if you don't intervene, you could help that some other hope that some other force would intervene.
Well, I would think we can presume that the five people are tied as close to the
okay,
the
so
track
there's
the
no other
is.
Possibility of saving
you have
the five
to make a
people.
Choice.
You're simply making a 5-1 choice, but implicating yourself directly. Yeah. I think, you have to divert the trolley to the one person.
Okay, let's do the audience. So do you let the train continue and hit the five people, or do you take an action, flip the switch so that it hits the one? So first, do you let it continue? Do you flip the switch and let it hit the one? Killers, murderers. Okay, now let's go to part two. Here's where it gets really tricky. You are standing on a bridge above the train or trolley track. Train is barreling down toward you. You notice that there are five people tied to the track. Just, I don't know what country
what
this is.
What are they doing there?
Five people are tied to the track.
And you're on a bridge?
You're on the bridge. However, you happen to be standing next to a fat person, and you can throw that fat person over off the bridge, and it will stop the train before it hits the five people who are tied. Do you throw the person off and save those five lives or not?
I think that if you answer yes to the first question, you are morally bound to answer yes to the second question. That the only difference is your lack of comfort with the very visceral physical act of the pushing the person, as opposed to the remoteness of the button.
Okay, the person in the audience just said, "I think you have to throw yourself," and the reason why that grotesque fat detail is there because the presumption is, you yourself are not heavy enough to stop this train. So the only solution is the morbidly obese person. How you are going to get a morbidly obese person if you're that don't have enough heft over this bridge abutment is one big problem for this hypothetical. But
I think I would engage in some futile attempt to find a third solution and fail and die in the process.
Yeah, there's no way you would actually do it, Emily.
I guess that's true, but then would you actually push the button too? And what does that say about us, that when there's a physical act which feels a little bit distant and is easy to do, pushing a button, we would choose it. Most of us would choose it. But when you're faced with a task that is more physically daunting and intimate, that then you turn away from it.
All right, we're going to go to the audience here for the right answer. So would you throw the fat guy onto the track to stop the train? All right. Would you not do that? So it's majorities to flip the switch but not throw the person.
I wish we could see the cross tabs on all this. Like, who wants to get rid of the Italian department and push the guy out of the tracks?
I think me. That yeah. would be me.
Because there are many Italian opera singers are hefty, and I should think that might be a correlative there.
You really, Emily, think that throwing someone over and an act of killing like that is the same as flipping a switch in the matter of kind of moral calculus and necessity?
So I only will defend what I said if it's just as certain that the second pushing will have the same effect as pushing the button.
Right.
And then if it's just as certain, I feel like what you're grappling with is the difficulty of physically killing someone, sort of like eating meat without ever actually killing an animal. And so I feel like if I'm going to own the pragmatism of saving the five people by pushing the button, that I have to also be willing to physically push someone.
She's...
But, right.
I guess my point is I don't see a moral difference between pushing a button and pushing a person. I see, like, a horrible, wrenching experience that would give you nightmares, but I don't see the moral distinction.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a good answer for this. Someone help me! Isn't there an Italian major out here who can help?
Okay, so I think it might have something to do with the kinds of actions that society sanctions long term. If we allow people to push buttons, nothing much happens a lot of the time. If we allow people to push people off of bridges anytime they want because they think that it might help, by and large, the world gets worse. So as a society, we tend to, you know, prescribe that sort of thing.
All right.
Great
well
answer.
Said.
All right. Now our conundrum.
Okay, so the conundrum is, if you're running for Congress in a tough district and you've got a scandal on your hands, would you rather it come out that you're gay or that you're an atheist?
What's your district? Where's your district?
Yeah, where are you? It's tough.
I don't think
it's tough. It's tough.
You always want it to be that you're gay now.
Yeah.
Always.
No,
well,
not
if you're running in
country,
Alabama, too.
There's no part in the country where it would be worse to be gay than an atheist. If there are places where it's already bad to be gay, it would be worse to be an atheist.
That's a shifting paradigm. I think
you
might
good.
Be close
that was
to
good.
Right,
that
but
was good.
That's actually pretty new.
That's good.
What's the things that would be worse than atheist, though? Pedophile would be worse than atheist.
Yes. Yes. Cannibal.
Cannibal is worse than atheist?
Not in David's district.
What about credit card scammer?
Then they'd ask you to run for higher office.
In an open marriage. Is in an open marriage worse than... That would be tough.
Devil worshipping?
Devil worshipping would probably be worse, but would Wiccan be worse than atheist?
It's a little weirder.
Not in every district.
All right. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next conundrum.
So I am from San Francisco originally, but I am now a graduate student at Florida State University. And thank you. And Emily wrote about this, I think, last week or the week before, and we've had this, our whole town's been consumed with this. Well, first, the first half of the semester it was awesome because we had this awesome quarterback when we were winning every single one of our football games. And then TMZ, the great journalist juggernaut, found out that there was this rape accusation that had been sort of forgotten by the Tallahassee Police Department. And I found myself really trapped between wanting to believe this young woman, what she had said, but also not wanting to immediately condemn the quarterback before all the evidence had come out. this week the prosecutor decided not to bring charges, but I was wondering if you guys could talk about sort of either specifically for this case or more generically, what do we do when these sort of things consume us and we can't actually find a totally conclusive answer for it legally or morally?
So the last line of this piece that the second piece I wrote about this said these are really difficult, excruciating cases for the criminal justice system. And then I said, I think that's about all you can say for sure. Yeah, I mean, I also struggled with feeling sympathetic to this woman who came forward and made this accusation and very skeptical of the notion that she would have lied because of the particular facts. She didn't actually know that it was Jameis Winston who she was with that night for a few weeks. So the notion that she had deliberately targeted him or was, you know, going after him for money just seemed, and also she made the kind of accusation that just never works out well for people who make allegations. She didn't really remember everything that had happened. She'd been drinking, but she wasn't completely unconscious. It was just like a bad set of facts to go to the police with, which made me feel like she probably wasn't lying. On the other hand, he deserves the benefit of having been essentially cleared, or at least being someone who is not going to be convicted of a crime. And so to always feel like there's some shadow hanging over him, given that, you know, we want to presume innocence, also seems wrong to me. So I think it's sort of important to think through the facts of what might have happened and acknowledge the possibility that there was an assault, but then also at this point probably start to let it go.
That wasn't a conundrum. That was just a question for Emily. All right. Here's a good one. Should you have kids before you're 25 or after you're 35?
So you have to pick one or the other.
You have to pick one or the other, yes.
Huh. So all the research for women suggests that you should wait. There's some pretty good studies about academics in particular that you're better off getting your career started and really making sure you have a handle on everything. And yet I still feel like I would pick before 25 because it seems so exhausting. The idea that right now I would be getting up with the baby is very tiring to me. I don't know if I could do it.
That's a good point.
But would you have derailed your career? I mean, wouldn't that have derailed your career in a way that...
Although, you know, I mean, it might have. But the thing that's funny about it is I think back to my first job and I think, like, whatever, what was I doing? I was working at a pretty lousy newspaper, actually a very lousy newspaper in the East Bay in California. I mean, I wasn't that busy. I don't know. I think it probably would have been okay. I was very anxious, though.
Yeah, you would have been, a mess. You were a mess at that age.
That's true. I'm not sure it would be so good for the child.
It would. It's not good. I don't think it's good for me.
Right.
Plus, also, there's a lot of things you've been through and understand and experience that are, I think, probably helpful for their raising. Or, I mean, I just may be screwing them up. But
what about the fact that you're just going to die sooner, probably? You're just not going to be around for as many years of the child's life. Does that not matter to anybody?
Oh, God.
No, I think that matters. I think if you could get away with sub-25, I was talking to some friends at my daughter's bat mitzvah actually this weekend, and they had their kids really young, and they're now in their early mid-50s, and one of their kids is married, the other one's starting a life, and that seems pretty good. They don't seem to have suffered terribly from that. Aren't kids healthier when you have them younger?
Yeah, that's the thing. Physiologically, it's got to be better to have them when you're younger.
Right. Older men, women struggle to get pregnant and sometimes have birth, but there are various potential birth defects and like a higher rate of autism with older fathers. I mean, it's still a tiny percentage, but.
Particularly in the kind of college-educated urban professional class.
Nobody has kids in their early 20s.
So shouldn't we be, just as a kind of cultural matter, shouldn't we be pushing for the pre-25s because we're taking it too far in the other direction right now? That there are too many
balancing measure.
Yeah, so that there are too many older parents relative to what they should be. I don't know. I mean, that's maybe just completely bogus. I'm not sure. Let's try the audience and see if this is, it stimulates us. Who thinks you should have your kids before 25? Did anyone who actually clapped there actually have a kid before 25? Okay.
It's
who think
great.
You should have it after 35? Is there anyone? This is a serious question. Is there anyone here who had a child before age of 25? That's amazing. That's amazing. That is that like a?
I don't
I don't think it's that class or demographic thing.
The average is now like 26 or 27.
Well, but these are all people who were born.
Right, true. But
years
even,
ago.
Yeah, but I don't think it's that. How old were your parents when they had your older brother? They were over 25, I bet.
Yeah.
My mom was 26.
All right. This is a good San Francisco question. From Glenn Shepard, who lives in some city in the Amazon. Would you rather have a great job in a maybe not so great city or a mediocre job in an awesome city?
Great job.
Yeah. I mean, I love my job and live in a slightly... I mean, I love New Haven, but it's not necessarily... All of you might choose to move there tomorrow. Maybe not.
So you had a job at the Tri-Valley Herald.
Right. And
then chose instead to have a better job in New Haven.
I left the Bay Area with a lot of sadness and remorse. But I still think that was right. I also think when you decide, this is a hard crowd to say this in front of. I didn't really think that through. However, when you decide to live in a less desirable place, all these vistas open before you. It's just easier because not that many other people want to be there. Like, the lines are shorter. Your kids can play soccer. There are just all these things that happened.
Well, I think this is very revealing of how one thinks about one's job. All of us are job hounds, right?
We think of work as really work, central right, this is to a, our identity.
Work is very central to your identity. If work is not so central to your identity, wouldn't you choose
Yeah, I think
location
it's totally legitimate
over
to
labor.
Choose that.
So what would you choose, Joan?
The work.
You would choose the work. You choose a
the work
great
the
job
location. Yeah.
Over location. I mean, that's you sort of have done that in Washington. Yeah.
See, right.
We both have done that.
We picked the wrong place.
No, that's why it's a great... That's why I would be interested to hear a counter-argument. And does there anyone
well,
who...
Well, the counter-argument.
Well, not from you. From someone who actually lives in a great city.
We have to. Wait.
So I'm interested. So is there anyone here who wants to articulate the argument for job, amazing city?
If it's an job, you have more time to explore your great city because it's presumably working less hours. It's not a demanding 60, 70-hour week schedule. So it's a normal 40-hour week job. You can go out and enjoy your nights with your friends, with your family. You're not dead tired all the time.
Lifestyle.
Different kind of quality of life. Yeah, you get your quality of life from other
dimensions.
But is this
sad fact about us, the sad, pathetic fact that we define ourselves and our status by our labor?
See, I also just want to stick up again for mediocre cities, I suppose, because I think that you can find that a lot of the things that make up one's daily life, daily pleasures are, you know, for example, do you have like a pleasant short commute to work, perhaps a bike ride even, that things like that, that are just easier to come by in a place where other people don't want to live there.
Okay, we'll do an audience poll, then we'll do an audience question. So the audience... We'll ask the audience, would you rather live in a crummy city with a great job? Would you rather live in a great city with a crummy job?
That was closer than
that
I would
was easy. Yeah, pretty even. Pretty even split.
I don't think so. The second group totally
second group
won.
Was definitely
well,
louder.
60-40.
They're okay. Healthier. They're
constantly out running around and being vigorous.
They're mountain biking and eating really good bread. That was all anyone talked about when I lived here.
Okay, let's have a audience question.
Would you rather be very ignorant and very happy, or very intelligent and aware and very unhappy?
I choose happy.
Happy.
Hands down.
Yeah. Yeah, no, sorry. I was just wondering what how much fun that would be. I think happy. I think it would just be nice to be happy.
Great. I kind of want to be ignorant.
Yeah, I mean, don't you wish for your children? I mean, certainly when I think about what I wish for my children, I wish happiness. It's happiness and health. Those
and yet we're not raising our children to be ignorant in the hopes that if they don't know about everything, they'll be happier.
No.
We feel a lot of responsibility to make sure they do know stuff.
Sure. But the choice is not, you know, you can raise them, you know, in a cage deprived of information and then they'll end up happy or not. I mean, it's...
Wait, have you ever had a situation where you were happy and then you found something out that made you unhappy and you would have preferred to have lived in ignorance of that?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
What?
I'm having trouble thinking of a specific thing, but basically any time you know that someone has said something mean about you, I always wish to unknow that, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. So we're going to turn to cocktail chatter, and we're going to bring on a special guest who is one of San Francisco's treasures, the greatest magazine editor in America, Clara Jeffrey, who's the co-editor of Mother Jones and a former colleague of mine many, many years ago. Clara.
Hey, sorry, I'm in my coat. It's even colder over there than it was in the green room, so thank God it's radio.
Are there any conundrums that we didn't grapple with that you think we should grapple with? You can get a free conundrum.
Well, one I've always loved is you're going to eat pie. You can only be guaranteed of excellence in either the crust or the filling.
Filling. I take a great filling
you
over a crust.
A great filling over a good crust.
Yeah. I'm going to pick the crust. I really like the crust of pies.
No, I think it's because like a pecan pie, yeah, you want the, I think, filling.
Clara?
I'm a total filling girl.
Filling. Let's check the audience. So do people think filling or crust? Filling first. Crust. How about crust? Fewer but louder, the crust people. Yeah. Fewer but louder.
Crust people are always passionate.
So our chatter is going to be, it's a different sort of chatter for a different sort of show. It's going to be our favorite moment of the year, since this is our year-end show. It can be any kind of moment. I'm going to go first because mine is less good than your guys's. So my favorite moment of the year was, it actually took place in California. I took a vacation with my family to San Diego, and we went out with a friend of mine who is a sand dune aficionado, a dune buggy racer, and he took us to Imperial Sand Dunes, which is outside of San Diego, a couple hours outside of San Diego. We raced his dune buggy up and down the dunes and slept out on the dunes out there. And the reason I loved it was that it created such conflict in me, because it's a thing which is a national park, or it's a national recreation area. Half of it is set aside for walking around and contemplation and not being destroyed. And then half of it is set aside for people to race dune buggies and four-wheelers and just make a ton of noise and wreck the place. And really, I thought the people who were wrecking the place just had it right. It just felt like this was a place that was born to be wrecked, that was born for people to take their high-powered machines and drive them into the ruination of the dunes. And I loved it. And it, obviously, as a kind of person who believes in national parks and quiet contemplation, I was torn by it. But it was...
You didn't want to be that person, yet.
I enjoyed it so... I enjoyed being that person so much. John, what is your moment of the year chatter?
My moment of the year chatter is... It's not really a moment, actually. The arrival of Pope Francis in our conversations. Mm. And I think there are two things that he... I mean, as a Catholic, it's nice to be... to talk, have people ask you about Pope Francis and not ask you about the priests and the young children. So he was riding in his car, and he sees a severely disfigured, we've talked about this maybe on the show before, severely disfigured man by the side of the road. He stops the car, gets out, kisses the man, embraces him, and then prays with him, which was just to me like an amazing act. But then the many, many different things he said, and just some of them that I find so striking, even if you're not religious at all, when he says, "I prefer a church which is bruised, hurting, and dirty because it's been out in the streets rather than a church which is unhealthy from being confined and from clinging to its own security." And then if, in a political context, to hear him say, "How can it be that it is not a news item when an elderly homeless person dies of exposure, but it is a news item when the stock market loses 2 points? I think this is, as Emily quite rightly put earlier, if somebody like me said that, it would sound trite and sort of lame. But when somebody with his position says that, I think it shocks and changes the conversation in a way that is good.
Yeah. Clara, what's your chatter?
Well, as tempting as it is to pick the Rob Ford meltdown, I think I'm going to go with a similarly upbeat story. And, you know, the SF Bat Kid really captured the hearts of the city and everyone across the country. And, you know, as a sort of grizzled reporter type, there was a moment, actually before it all happened, where I was like, is this really the best use of the city's money? Like, and also as the mom of a five-year-old, like, is this kid going to really be able to deal with all this excitement, especially if he's sick? But it was just so endearing, and it made the whole country come together for this wonderful moment. And I don't know, it was went right to the heart of the person that also loves Love Actually and just sentimental stuff. So,
I haven't followed it. Has Bad Kid stopped any crime since that day?
No, but he's A, coming back, and B, there's like a little installation down at one of the points of where he, you know, captured the Riddler or something. So it seems to be a perennial thing for the city now.
One of the great conundrums, which we didn't tackle, but which I'll leave for you guys for your later post-Digestif discussions, is it moral for any superhero to take a vacation? That if you're a superhero, isn't it your obligation to be on the clock all the time rescuing people? Because when you go and spend a few hours dating Lois Lane, thousands of people are getting killed.
Opportunity costs.
So. But then you can have sequels, really. You know, it sort of removes the ability to have that angst-ridden sequel.
We'll let you guys decide. Emily, what's your chatter of the year?
My moment this year were the Supreme Court's gay marriage decisions for a few reasons. One is that it's so unusual that a court decision or really even a law can actually really improve people's lives and solve a problem. And when we're talking about formal equality, laws and courts do have that power. And for our Supreme Court, with all its flaws, to take that position really is changing people's lives in this measurable way, which I think growing up wouldn't have really been conceivable to me, but has become one of the civil rights battles of our era. And I don't feel like I've been alive to get to see a lot of other victories like that. And then selfishly, it's the only issue I get to cover where there's real progress and movement. And so it was just incredibly satisfying as a journalist to be watching this story unfold that just had so much potential in it.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things discussed on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows, including this week's Culture Gabfest special on language, at iTunes, SoundCloud, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. I'm the executive producer, Andy Bowers. For everyone on the GabFest crew, happy holidays, and we'll talk to you next week.